Live from Mexico, this is the Fan Weirdom Shorts NATO. I'm doing another episode without Shorts. Shorts will be back soon. But today I am joined by Lawrence Nahum and Ben Kaufman. We ran into each other here and Lawrence told me, Lawrence is working on a new, well, you're working on a hardware wallet. And I figured, you know what, Shorts and I have never done an episode on hardware wallets. So maybe this is a good opportunity to just keep it going. The other reason is, well, first, okay, let's, Lawrence, introduce yourself, please. Let's start there.
All right, Lawrence Nahum, chief architect of Blockstream. I worked on various software wallets and now Jade hardware wallet.
Yeah, the green wallet, the Blockstream green wallet. Yep. That was your main project before this.
Yeah.
And now you're working on the Jade hardware wallet, also a Blockstream product.
Yeah.
Ben?
Yeah, I'm Ben Kaufman. I'm working on Spectre Wallet. It's a way to use your Bitcoin core node with hardware wallets, basically all of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to do an episode on hardware wallets, and I've never really written extensively about hardware wallets, like the trade-offs there are, and there is some, you know, debate and discussion on what are, you know, the best hardware wallets or what are the best trade-offs to make. And so I figured if I'm going to do this episode with a developer of one hardware wallet, I kind of want to have a neutral expert sitting next to me to kind of tell me if, Lawrence, if you're overselling everything like you always do. Everyone knows that you. So Ben is going to be my sort of sidekick expert today. So if Lawrence, yeah, I'll have questions for you here and there. If I don't understand something or if Lawrence is, overselling his.
I will watch him.
Call me out.
I'll be watching him.
And it's really cool to have you on as well, Lawrence, because when Shorts and I started our podcast, so you also do the Reckless Review podcast, right? So,
yes, we do.
So when Shorts and I, when we started our podcast, we were sort of making benchmarks for ourselves, but we didn't want to disappoint ourselves. So we figured, all right, our podcast needs to be at least as good as Reckless Review. So we set it like the lowest
very,
bar
very
possible.
Low bar, yeah.
So there's no way we could fail. So so it's great you're on as well. All right, let's start with a very basic question. Guys, what is a hardware wallet? Why do people use hardware wallets or what are they for?
I'll start.
Yeah.
And maybe before I say what a hardware wallet is, I'll say what a wallet is. A wallet is just some piece of software that holds your private keys and together with those, it signs your transactions and maybe generates addresses and so on. So hardware wallet, it's just like a software wallet, but it has a much smaller surface of attack. So it's a device that is dedicated to one thing. So unlike your mobile where you can, you know, read the news, download video games, watch movies and so on, a hardware wallet does just one thing and that's, you know, signing transactions, showing addresses and so on. And yeah.
I think one big benefit, but correct me if I'm wrong, that goes for both of you, is that a hardware wallet isn't connected to the internet and therefore it can be hacked by outside parties in that way at least. Would you agree that's a main benefit or no?
I don't agree in the sense that ultimately your laptop is connected to the internet and your hardware wallet is connected to your laptop.
Right. At some point, your hardware wallet is going to hit the internet indirectly.
At least that's the most common case. I mean, some people use offline laptops and so on, and you can definitely do that. But there's some work involved. And, sometimes, you know, some devices use cable. Some devices support cable as well as Bluetooth. Some devices support SD cards. And some devices maybe use QR code. But even those are still like a way to get, say, potentially code on those devices and maybe attack them.
So if the main benefit is that it's a single purpose computer, if that's how you explain it, I think, right? If I summarize it in like one sentence, it's a one purpose computer. Why is that actually a good thing then? Why is that a benefit? Why is that something people want?
It's because it's not just a single-purpose computer. It's a small single-purpose computer that has been hardened to minimize, what you can do with it, and thus there's less surface of attack. So the more software, the more bugs, the more security issues. Because it's single-purpose, it has less code, less software, and so less less bugs. But also, depending on the manufacturer, it may have some different kind of hardening. So maybe we'll get into that a little bit later.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a bit. First, Ben, do you agree with this? Is this the main benefit of hardware wallets?
I would say so. I think not being connected to the internet is just one part of this, reducing the attack surface. So it's a very important one, but there is a lot more into it. So it's not just not connected to the internet, it's also that it's very much minimized, like everything that you don't really need is just not there anymore.
Yeah, so there's just less risk if there's less stuff, right? So let's get into some hardware wallets. We'll get into the Jade wallet in a bit, but let's discuss some of the trade-offs that hardware wallets have made over the years, because there are different designs of hardware wallets. The first hardware wallet was Trezor. So how does Trezor, for example, work? Why is that secure or why is that not secure? Maybe that's your opinion.
So Trezor is a USB device. There's a tool, I think, now. Trezor T and Trezor 1, but basically it's a small computer, a small device. I think it has a chip called the ST32 from ST Electronics. I think it's a French company. They designed some firmware in C, drives the display and listens to button events.
Maybe in case someone doesn't know, what is firmware?
What is that software actually? Software for hardware.
Yeah, it's software specifically designed for a piece of hardware.
Yes, right. And usually, maybe I'm wrong, but I think usually like it goes without operating system and it's like bare bone to the iron, to the hardware, to the metal.
Right.
Yes. Not in all hardware wallets, but yes, in most of them.
Right, so a Trezor is a piece of hardware with a piece of firmware, and that firmware secures your private keys and can be used to sign transactions, usually through another wallet like Spectre, for example.
Mm-hmm. And Green supports Trezor too.
Right, and then you broadcast that to the Bitcoin network. And that's how it works. So the main purpose is there, it secures your keys in that sense. Now, I think one of the trade-offs of Trezor, so it usually works, like it's secure in that sense, until someone gets a hold of your actual Trezor. I think that's... Is that sort of one of the trade-offs or one of the problems there?
Not necessarily. So Trezor is open source. The firmware is open source. I think the hardware is also open source, or at least used to be.
From what I know, it's open source.
And it has some... it tries to, you know, prevent extraction of keys and you know... unless you know the PIN or the passphrase, it prevents you from using it. But basically, unless you use a passphrase, it doesn't have physical security, because a number of independent companies or people managed to extract the secret, the private keys, the seed, the mnemonic.
Yeah, physical security is what I refer to. Like if you actually get the device in your hand.
Unless it has a strong passphrase, in which case you can't. You can extract the mnemonic, but then without the passphrase, you cannot get the keys.
Yeah, let's separate that out real quick. We mentioned so there's a PIN. Every hardware wallet usually has a PIN code. You just need to put the PIN in.
Yeah.
And then there's the private keys so you need a PIN to unlock the private keys, basically. But if you get it, and then there's the passphrase, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
So if you use a passphrase, which is just a password or just a long version of a password.
It needs to be strong. If it's like in a dictionary, then it's trivial to brute force.
Yeah, so if you have a Trezor and someone uses it with a passphrase, then it's as secure as the passphrase, at least. The problem is sort of that the PIN doesn't provide the security in case of a physical attack. Am I saying this right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so how would this physical attack, like, how does it work? Or is that even known? Or
basically, you open the case of the Trezor, and you, in jargon, it's called the glitch. You glitch it. There's various kind of glitches. Power glitches is one. I'm not an expert in the sense that I've never teached hardware or never done this, but basically, yeah, you. I also heard that sometimes they use laser to glitch Trezor, and by glitching it, you basically change the instructions, and if you time it right, it works really well, and you can bypass the pin protection, for example.
Right.
And you can extract the seed.
Right. So that's the main downside of Trezor. The main upside, I think, and you did mention this, but I want to make this more clear, is that it's completely open source. So we know exactly what the device is doing, what the firmware is doing, how it all works. Is that right?
Yep.
Yes.
Right. And then, okay, so that's Trezor. And that's sort of, I think, and that's why, that's one of the reasons I mentioned Trezor as first. I think that's sort of on one end of that spectrum, of the sort of security trade-off spectrum, is that it's all open source, you know exactly what it's doing. But if someone gets their hand on the actual device and didn't use a strong passphrase, then it can be extracted in the way you just explained. So that's sort of one end of the spectrum. And then, as I understand it, on the other end of the spectrum, there's something like Ledger, which uses a secure chip, I believe.
A secure element.
A secure, yeah. So how does this work?
Well, it's a chip that has extra protection, both in terms of glitching and in terms of...
all sorts of known attacks, basically. Whatever it's decapping the chip, whatever it's glitching it, whatever it's tempering it with temperature or whatever you can do.
So maybe I should first ask, and maybe you were answering that question, but just to make the question very clear then, what is a secure element? Why is it secure? Why is it even called that? What is it?
It's a chip like the same that Trezor uses, but it has extra protection. So Ben was talking about capping or uncapping. That's the process of removing layer by layer the material until you can actually see the
what
secrets,
it's doing.
The secrets of the chip. And secure elements tend to have extra protection against that, so that basically it's very hard to use like an electronic microscope to read into the chip, say the flash to extract the key or whatever. I think I'm not, you know, again, an expert on this, but I believe it has like a little, like an electrical net that will destroy as soon as you, it will prevent you from reading, and if you try to move it, it will destroy the circuit, mm-hmm. something like that.
Right, it's essentially a tamper-proof chip. But then,
but then it comes. Usually, those chips come with NDAs or in any capacity. It's like the tool chain. Often, it's not available to third parties unless they sign the NDA or it's not open source and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually the downside.
Yeah, so that's a trade off there. So the benefit is because of this secure element, this physical attack cannot be done.
They can. It's a matter of price. So maybe with Trezor. I heard that you can get equipment for, say, $200 to extract the key with secure elements.
And is that software or?
It's hardware.
It's actual hardware.
Tools, yes, but it's very cheap.
Yeah. It used to be more expensive, but basically it's some hardware that allows you to glitch it at the right time so that, you know, some instructions get executed or don't get executed.
And that kind of hardware does not exist for the secure element, or it exists, but it's just way more expensive.
It exists. It's way more expensive to extract because you're going to have far more failures. And, you know, maybe we're talking about $200 for Trezor. Maybe we're talking about $200,000 for Ledger, or maybe even $2 million for Ledger.
Mm-hmm. And even then, it's much less guaranteed that you will manage to do that. It's way more risky because it's tamper-proof.
Yeah,
because
the thing is, you don't care about... Like, sometimes you care about extracting something from these secure element chips, and if you burn one, you don't care because you can, you know, buy more and try until you succeed. But in case of a Bitcoin wallet, you do care about succeeding on that specific wallet that has the coins. Otherwise, you know, you don't really care about breaking an empty wallet.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So because of the secure element, it's much more expensive to extract the that's always the word I'm struggling with.
Mnemonic.
Thank you, Lawrence. That's much, or the private keys, basically. Yeah. So that's much harder to subtract. The trade-off is that you don't know exactly what the chip is doing. Is that it?
That's part of it, I would say.
But even with the other chip, like ST32, I mean...
It's not open source.
It's not open
the chip
source.
Itself, it's, I mean, the chip of all the hardware wallets out there is an open source. I think Trezor is working on an open source chip.
Yes.
In fact, maybe an open source secure element.
Yes.
But basically, all the chips out there are currently not open source. The spec may be open, and the toolchain may be open, but not always. Like for secure element, it tends to be closed, and it tends to be covered by NDA.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what is the problem with that then exactly, in your own words?
Well, the,
if there is a problem with it.
For example, with Trezor, there's a few clones, and if someone has somewhat basic you know, electronic skills, they can build one themselves and flash the firmware themselves and whatnot.
You mean if someone else wants to sell hardware wallets, it's very easy for them to take Trezor's firmware, their work, and sell hardware wallets yourself. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, there's plenty of Trezor clones, and
but
in
that's
fact, even Coldcard uses firmware that originates from Trezor in terms of, you know, they forked it from Trezor early on, and then they moved on.
Right, but I'm interested in what are the problems for users. Why is it for a user, for me, if I want to secure my private keys, why is it the problem for me to use a secure element, or is it not a problem for me to use that?
I would say it's mostly that they are covered by NDAs usually, and they're closed source mostly, which adds to, you know, it adds to the obscurity and risk in terms of you are not necessarily knows what the stuff is doing. So sometimes it can be with the chips too and like normal, but this basically just adds another layer where you don't know what things are, what's going on.
So what's the worst that could be going on then?
Mm-hmm.
Well, so for example, each hardware wallet has a random number generator, and you know, maybe the keys generated are all known by ledger. Now, this could—it's also possible with Trezor, to be honest, because the chip used by Trezor could do that. So it could be, you know, hidden in hardware. But my point previously was like, if I wanted to, and forget about you know, commercializing it, I could build a Trezor from scratch,
mm-hmm.
and flash it and use it. A ledger, I simply couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. But that's the commercial argument. I'm still interested.
No.
It's
even for build it
like
DIY, yourself, like a DIY. Yes.
Oh, just as a matter of better
extra
understanding
security.
What it's doing and right.
Also, extra
that
security in both terms of supply chain attacks. So it's if you're building it your own, there is much less risk in that, and also in terms of the hardware security. So if like Trezor would want to execute some retirement attack and hide something in the chip, then if you're building it yourself, you cannot really do that.
Right, got it. Is it kind of be summarized into saying the secure elements require more trust? Is that
to some extent, I would say yes.
So you it requires some more trust in the wallet developer to an extent.
Yeah, yeah.
And well, and the manufacturer
of
the chips themselves.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's take a quick break from that episode. I want to tell you guys about our sponsor. It is Bitcoin 2022 conference. I am sure you saw the videos. You may have been there in person. Bitcoin 2021 was an absolute smashing success. It was the biggest conference in Bitcoin history, crypto history, whatever history of the digital asset sphere. Bitcoin is number one, and the Bitcoin 2021 conference is number one with a bullet. It was an absolutely incredible time. I was working my ass off the whole time, but I got to meet so many incredible community members. And I think the best testament to how amazing Bitcoin 2021 was not just all of the amazing, you know, accolades and compliments that I got personally and our team got, but also it's the skin in the game in Bitcoin 2022. We have already sold close to 1,500 tickets. That is more than 10% of the people, everyone who went to Bitcoin 2021 have already purchased tickets to Bitcoin 2022. We have not released a date. We have not released a city. We have not released anything. That is the biggest compliment. That is the biggest skin in the game of the community being down for this conference. Bitcoin 2022 is going to be bigger than Bitcoin 2021. Is going to be better than Bitcoin 21 in every single way. And we are going to be bringing you the best opportunity to mingle with the biggest, the baddest, the most Bitcoin people on the planet. So join the revolution. Go to b.tc/conference. Get your tickets today. I don't know what the ticket prices are. They are going up. I think they're $249 right now. We just rolled out fiat ticket purchases. All the tickets purchased before today were all purchased in BTC. So get it, guys. Get it. Get this ticket. Be at Bitcoin 2022. See you there. Bitcoiners, I want to tell you guys about The Deep Dive. The Deep Dive is a new premium newsletter from the Bitcoin Magazine team in conjunction with my man, BTCization, Dylan LeClaire. Dylan is such a multifaceted and wide-ranging analyst. He does everything from on-chain analytics to macro analysis to hash rate and all that kind of good stuff. He does it all. He breaks down everything that's happening every single day with his daily dive. He's going to dive into what is happening in the market that day. So that way you don't have to pay attention to Twitter. You don't have to pay attention to anything else. You can just pay attention to The Deep Dive, and he has you covered. And at the end of the week, guess what? You get a weekly recap. And at the end of the month, hey, we have a freaking report, a beautiful PDF breaking down all the activity of that entire month, what it means for Bitcoin, what you can expect moving forward. The Bitcoin market is going to moon. We are here to make sure that we maximize your stack. Go to members.bitcoinmagazine.com to sign up today. And if you use promo code BITS, you can get 1 month for free. So again, The Deep Dive, I've been checking it out every day, and you should too. Back to the show.
So that's, I think that these are sort of the two polar opposites or the two extremes within the hardware wallet space a little bit. On the one hand, you have Trezor that is completely open source in all its ways, but that comes with a trade-off that a physical tech is possible, and then, or at least, you know, affordable, I guess. And then on the other end, you have Ledger, which has a secure element, which is therefore not as, or it's much more expensive to perform a physical tech on, but it requires some level of trust on the wallet provider and the developers.
And it's only partially open source. Like Ledger has some open source parts, but it's only partially open source.
Yeah. Was this, Ben, you agree this was sort of the enough?
In that sense, yes.
Right.
At least from that aspect, yes.
Okay. So then there are other hardware wallets. Before we get to Jay, let's discuss one other hardware wallet. It's the
Cold Card.
Yeah, they have a security model that sits in between of these two.
Kind of,
polar
yes.
opposites. Yeah.
So it has two chips. And so Trezor and Ledger use a chip, called SD. I mean, from a company called SD. I believe that Cold Card has one chip from SD and one chip from Atmel. The SD is almost the same as Trezor, if not the same as Trezor. It's an ST32 or something like that. While the Atmel is a secure chip. It's not, I mean, some people call it a secure element, some people call it a secure chip, but it's not used, unlike Ledger, it's not used to sign transaction. It's only used almost as a black box to hold the keys against your PIN. And if you get the PIN wrong, I don't know how many times, it will delete the secret. So when you get the PIN right, it will provide the key to the other chip. The chip will do whatever it needs to do, while Trezor style, until it's powered or until you like log out, say, of the wallet, and then you know it will disappear from memory and will be protected by this Atmel.
Right. So two chips. One of them is pretty regular, same as what something like Trezor uses.
Yeah.
And the other is more like what Ledger uses?
No,
not quite.
But the important thing is that in Ledger model, all the operations for signing transactions happening on the secure element itself. On the Cold Card, it's not happening on the secure chip. It's happening on the normal chip. The only thing the secure chip is used for is storing the keys themselves, but they are getting loaded into the other chip while the Cold Card is actually in use.
Yeah, no, that I got. But you also mentioned the secure element isn't quite as secure, or how do I think about that then? Or is it just a secure element that does less?
I mean, in principle, you could say it's a secure element that does less. I heard of it as a secure chip, but not exactly a secure element. And so another thing that secure elements tend to do and the code that you run on it is very important as well, is that it makes it harder to extract the key by means of listening. So at some point, someone was trying to extract the private key from a Trezor by signing lots of times and trying to capture, because it wasn't a constant time code. So signing different things meant that it would take, you know, different lengths and of time, and that is enough information to eventually extract the private key. And secure element tend to have not only hardware accelerators for crypto, but also you know, tend to leak less in terms of you know, electromagnetical information.
Right. So in any case, in the Coles cards, there are two chips, and one of the chip, which is sort of the secure elements, in this case, in the sense that we just discussed, and that just holds the private keys. Does it generate the private keys?
I think with Cold Card, you have various ways. You can generate the private keys even with coins or dice or like externally. I'm not sure which chip they use between the two to create the you know, the private keys. Do you
I'm
know,
not
Ben?
Sure about the initial randomness, but they also offer you to use dice rolls, I think.
So is there, what kind of trust is there, if any, is there still trust involved there? Is like, what would be the worst case scenario there then, if the secure element turns out to not be secure or turns out to be backdoored? Are there,
there can always be a bad, even if the mnemonic is completely random and it's not like backdoored, like the generation of the mnemonic itself. It is still possible, for example, to leak some of the private key information while signing Bitcoin transactions. And for people, it will look like noise. Only for the guy who put the backdoor, he will be able to actually read that. So there is always some risk, I would say. But usually it's not, I would not say it's a very high risk usually.
You think the risk compared to, for example, the Ledger, you know, Polar, that side, you think the risk is in fact is diminished by using two separate chips?
No, I think it's more or less the same in that sense, I would say. From that aspect, I think it's more or less the same.
I would say it sits in the middle between Trezor and Ledger. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Ledger is a little bit more secure. But it's a nice design because you can keep the rest open source, and this mm-hmm. chip is not used for almost anything other than securing the mnemonic. Obviously, the chip could have some errata or some bugs or some other problem that allows to bypass the pin or, you know, to extract the key somehow. But at the moment, there's no known mm-hmm. issues with that.
So at least there you can sort of inspect or understand more parts of, you know, how the wallet works mm-hmm. compared to a Ledger, where in a Ledger, sort of everything happens in the dark, to call it that. Well, I don't know.
Yes,
is that a good way to put it?
Well,
with the OpenDime, more parts of it are open, and therefore, what did I say? OpenDime?
Yes,
yeah, Coles Card. Yeah, Coles Card. With the Coles Card, more stuff is happening in the open then, and therefore you can sort of verify more of it and see what, you know, there's less room for attack again.
Yeah,
right.
Okay, so the Coles Card uses two chips. One of them is a secure chip, secure element, whatever you want to call it. The other is a regular chip. The secure chip only stores the private keys and the rest is open source. Therefore, there's less, you know, you have a better idea of what's actually happening and what's going on. So that's why it sort of sits in between the Trezor, where everything is open source, but it has this downside that you can extract the keys if you have physical access to the device and you don't use that extra passphrase. And then on the other end, Ledger, where it's all sort of in a secure element, so you can't extract the keys. But there's the trade-off that you don't really have the same level of knowledge or control of what's actually happening.
Yeah, to give you an idea, once you put the PIN and the private keys are loaded on the non-secure chip in the Cold Card, technically, at that point, you could try to extract the keys, but you know, if someone takes your Cold Card from, you know, your desk or something, usually it's not, you know.
They can't get the private key because these are still locked in the secure chip.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So yeah, that's sort of the main free, I think, sort of the, or at least to give an idea of what hardware wallets are and what the different trade-offs are that they make. So now let's get to your hardware wallet, Jade wallet.
Yep.
So what trade-offs does the Jade wallet make? Why is there a new hardware wallet needed?
Well, so let me start from the chip because continuing the conversation we just had.
Yes.
It doesn't have a secure element. It has a chip with some security features, such as secure boot and flash encryption. And basically, the secure boot part means that you cannot flash any firmware on it that is not signed by Blockstream unless you get the, a DIY version.
Flashing it basically means copying it.
No. Right. Flashing as in upgrading the firmware, upgrading the software on the device requires a signature that is checked during, flashing and bootloader. And the flash encryption works by, there's some effuses. Effuses are basically a part of memory of the chip that once written cannot be rewritten. And specifically, these effuses are only readable by hardware, which means you cannot read the key that is then used to encrypt the flash, which is using, in case of Jade, is using AES.
This sounds very complicated to me right now. So let's break this down. First of all, there's one chip in the Jade, or two?
Well, when there's only one chip when it comes to running the firmware or touching your private keys and so on. There's actually a couple of more chips. One, it's used to control power to the display or power to the camera and so on.
There's one main chip for security.
Yeah, it doesn't have a secure element. That's
Even Ledger Nano S, for example, has two chips, but the second chip is only used to drive the display or the buttons.
Sure, yeah. When I say one chip or two, or in this context, I guess I'm talking about the security sensitive stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So it has
only one chip.
One chip. And is this chip open source or no?
Well, no chips are open source at the moment for all hardware wallets. So there is no open chip. The PCB or the board schematics and everything are open source. I would say it's like Trezor in this sense.
It's more like Trezor in that sense.
Yes.
Okay.
But
you mentioned there's also something secure.
It has some more security feature than the ST32 that Trezor uses. This is it's a chip called ESP32. It's produced by a company called Espressif in Shanghai, and they use a technology stack created by an American company called Cadence. The architecture is called Extensa, while say Cold Card and Trezor use an ARM chip.
All right, so am I understanding correct that this chip, it's a bit like a secure element, but it uses a different technique in that sense?
Well, it has some secure element features, but not as many as especially hardware measures as say the secure element used by Ledger. It also doesn't have as many say government or military certification as secure elements do, but it does have some relatively strong security feature.
Right. So in a way, this chip on its own sort of sits in between the security models of Trezor on the one hand and Ledger on the other. Is that the right way to look at it? That's just the chip.
Yes. And I would argue it's a little bit closer to Ledger than Trezor. I don't know to what extent, but that's where I think it sits.
Right. And then I think there is another, there's more to this wall. There's another sort of layer of security to sort of cover up for the fact that it's not as secure as Ledger in this sense. By the way, before we continue, do you agree with the summary,
yes,
Ben?
More or less, yeah. I pretty much agree with it, yes.
Okay, so to sort of compensate for the fact that this chip alone is not as secure as the Ledger secure element, and at least for these physical attacks, there's another layer of security with the Jade wallet. Is that right?
Basically, we use all the security features that the chip has, but we kind of assume that someone will manage to break them, or that maybe there's a bug, or maybe, you know, we assume that that wasn't enough. And so we created something that is kind of novel in the hardware wallet space. It's something that, it's basically an improvement over a protocol that we designed for Green many years ago, because you cannot really encrypt private keys with a PIN, because it's trivial to brute force. Let's say you have a 4-digit PIN, that's 10,000 tentatives, right? From 0 to 9999, right? And so that's terrible as encryption, right? It's trivial to brute force. And
a PIN is not enough, is what you're saying.
Yeah. A password would work if it's a good password with good entropy and not like not easy to find in a dictionary or something. Or even, you know, even a phrase in a book would be bad, because people are brute forcing all sorts of things nowadays. Mm-hmm. And so we created a protocol where we can actually enforce 3 tentatives of the PIN, and we use strong encryption for the private keys for the mnemonic. We use AES-256. And there's basically a blind PIN server. By blind, I mean it doesn't know anything about you. It doesn't know anything about your public keys, or even the private keys, or IPs, or anything like that, or email, or nothing. There's the firmware of Jade has the public key of the server embedded, like it's written in the firmware, and there is
a server somewhere, and the server has a public key. And that is embedded in the firmware of the hardware wallet.
Yes, mm-hmm. And the server is open source. You can run your own if you want. We recently added the functionality so that you can run your own if you don't want to use ours. And we're also currently working on a design where we have multiple servers with redundancies and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, yeah, there's a protocol where there's a negotiation. There's a key, a password. An encryption key that's generated. And you provide a PIN to the server. The server doesn't actually see your PIN. They see a hash of the PIN plus some nonce that is kept on Jade, on the hardware. And if you provide the right one, it will give you this key that it's used to encrypt the private key or the mnemonic.
Okay, hang on. Normally, the private keys on a hardware wallet are encrypted, if we even can call it that, with a PIN.
No, but they're not encrypted. Usually, they're not encrypted.
Oh, wait, so what does the PIN do then? They're protected by a PIN. Oh, but that's not
encryption. It just checks if the PIN is correct, then it will use the private key, or if it's not correct. Basically, there's no point ever encrypting something with the 4 digits.
Right. So, but on your wallet, the keys are encrypted.
Not only are they encrypted because we use flash encryption, but then on top of that, we encrypt it again with a key that is kept on a remote server. Which you can run on your own and works with Tor and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that instead of using a passphrase or just a non-encrypted access by a PIN, we encrypt with strong encryption, 256 AES. And the key is not on Jade. The key is on a remote server, and the server will only give it to you if you get the PIN right. If you get the PIN wrong 3 times, both Jade and the server will delete.
So there's an external connection. You need the PIN to get the key from the server, which in turn decrypts the keys on your device.
Yes.
Did I explain it?
Yeah.
Right.
But there is no actual connection from Jade to the server. It's just that when you connect it to, say, your Android or iOS or desktop or laptop or whatever, your software wallet will communicate with the hardware wallet, and there's this bit where if you want to enter the PIN, there's going to be a message that gets passed to the companion app, and then companion app passes it to the server. Now, the companion app is completely blind to this, so it doesn't know whether you're requesting or setting a PIN. It doesn't know the contents of these messages, because all the communication between the device and the remote endpoint are encrypted.
Before we get back to the episode, I want to tell you guys about Bitcoin Magazine. Bitcoin Magazine is the oldest publication covering Bitcoin, and we've been covering Bitcoin since 2012. Y'all, I'm so proud to be working for Bitcoin Magazine. We spend all day trying to scour the internet for the top news, the top plebs, the top subjects, conversations, everything that has to do with BTC, the asset, BTC, the culture, BTC, the revolution. We are here for it. We are here for BTC and BTC only, and we want to give back to the Bitcoin community. Hit us up if you want to contribute, and yeah, go follow us on Twitter. Go subscribe to this podcast. Go follow us on YouTube. All of the places that you can find Bitcoin Magazine, we are there. Instagram, Reddit, everywhere. We're there. We're there. Follow us for the best Bitcoin knowledge. Back to the episode.
So in that sense, the extra layer of security, I guess, if I'm getting it right, is that normally with a physical attack, you get the device in your hand and you can sort of keep spoofing the keys, the pin. I mean, you can keep spoofing the pin or in some way extract it or something.
To glitch it in some way, then yes.
Yeah, especially with the open source types then, right? That was sort of the problem there. In this case, because you're not 100, well, you're adding an extra layer of security. So that in this case, there's definitely a server that's also required to decrypt it. And if the server sees a pin three times that's not correct, then the keys are deleted.
Yeah.
The decryption key is deleted.
Yeah, encryption, decryption, it's deleted. But also Jade will notice that you got it wrong three times and will also delete everything. Mm-hmm. Just like the other hardware wallet. You could almost see it as a cold card, but instead of an ST32, the chip has some higher security features like encryption and secure boot. And then the other chip, instead of being on the device, is kind of remote.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that also cold card has secure boot, but I'm not 100% sure about that. But anyway, yes, I would say that instead of having the main difference is that instead of having the chip, everything in like on the device, then there is another protection layer, which is from a remote place.
So the most obvious question that comes to my mind is what happens if the server goes offline? Does that, in that case, it means your coins are locked, gone?
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons we have the server being open source and you can run your own, and also the redundancy of the new design that we're having for the blind pin server. But ultimately, you have like the device could break, just like all hardware wallets can break, or you know maybe you forget them in the washing machine or something in your clothes or whatever. The point is you need to have a mnemonic backup or you know private key backup, and if the server is down, you can just use the backup.
So as long as you have the backup, you're safe, even if the server goes down. The only difference compared to other hardware wallets is that if this the server goes down and you don't have a backup, then just the pin will not be enough compared to other hardware wallets where it will be. That's the main difference, I'd say.
Right. Yeah, that's important to mention because you basically always need a backup for a wallet anyways, for a hardware wallet. Mm-hmm. Like you, and in this case, you would still have the backup even if the server goes offline. You still have that.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
You would still. By the way, Jade has a modality, a mode that works without the pin. Without the pin server, and the mnemonic is remembered as long as the device is powered. As soon as you power it off, it's all gone. So you could have, you know, a situation where you just, even if the server is down, you just enter the keys again. Sorry, the mnemonics again on the device, and you can use it without the pin server.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As an emergency situation.
Okay, so we've now covered four hardware wallets. So let me see if I can sort of explain the trade-offs here in a decent way. And Ben, please correct me if I'm mm-hmm. making a big mistake here somewhere. All right, so on the one end of the spectrum, we sort of have Trezor, which is the most open source, I would summarize, but it has the problem that the keys can be extracted in case of a physical attack unless you add a passphrase. And on the other end, of the spectrum, there's Ledger. It has a secure element, so the keys cannot be extracted, but there's some trust involved in a way in what's actually going on that secure element. Then we discussed the cold card, which has two chips, so it sort of minimizes the secure element thing. It still has some secure elements, but it does the absolute minimum possible, and the rest is used in an open source way.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the Jade wallet, which you just explained, which has sort of one chip that, you know, instead of two, it's one which sort of sits between completely open source and completely secure elements. You think it's closer to secure elements, but then there's an extra layer of security involved with the, there's a signature needed from a server in order to actually be able to spend the coins. Did I summarize it okay?
Not a signature or like a decryption key, but yeah, more or less.
Right. Okay. So these are sort of the main security trade-offs of these four wallets. And there are more wallets, but we kind of cover the spectrum. And then there are more wallets that have their own trade-offs that sit somewhere in between or their own designs in other ways. Actually, that is a good point to bring up. There are other differences between the hardware wallets, of course. We've now discussed the hardware, the security trade-offs, but let's very briefly maybe mention some of the other design choices that could be interesting for people to know about, like how does it connect to your computer, or there are these kinds of differences as well, right, Lawrence?
Yeah, so USB is the first thing that came out, like with Trezor, right?
That's how you connect it to
the computer. That's how you connect it to your computer or to your phone, even if you have the right cable or adapter. Then Ledger came out with the Nano X, which has Bluetooth support. Coldcard came out with SD card support, as well as cable, USB cable. There's some that use QR code. JD is kind of using USB as well as Bluetooth as well as QR codes. QR codes are not enabled yet in the firmware.
But it actually has like a camera thing, right?
To scan QR codes. Which we do use internally for debugging and testing, like loading the mnemonics faster than having to type them in, for example. But that's only for development at the moment. And actually, this affects also trade-offs in terms of security, because everything with radio, it's easier to attack remotely, which is why we have like two firmware variants, one with BLE support and one without, and it's not even compiled in and it's completely disabled. There's various ways.
You mentioned that there's some security trade-off maybe involved, but this is mostly about usability, this kind of stuff.
I mean, yes. For example, on iOS, there's no way other than Bluetooth or maybe QR codes to use iOS. And so if you want to use iOS, Bluetooth is kind of like the way forward.
Right. Okay, then I want to ask one last question, because we're going to have to, the podcast has been getting pretty long and also pretty heavy, I think. You have a intense stare, Lawrence. You're zoned in. One last question. Okay, the concept of hardware wallets itself. There is the argument that the whole concept of hardware wallets itself is not a really good idea. Exactly, because now you have a device that's explicitly intended to store your private keys, and that everyone knows is explicitly intended to store your private keys. So that makes it sort of a target. So that can be a supply chain attack kind of thing, or maybe other types of, even the physical attack. It's, if you see a Trezor laying around, you know what it is. And so you know that that's something that's probably storing private keys. Well, if you just use a phone that's your, you buy a cheap phone, you do nothing else with it, you just use it as a hardware wallet, then no one will know that there's Bitcoins on it, presumably, and there's also much smaller risk for supply chain attacks. What do you think about this argument sort of against hardware wallets in general?
Well, you're right. I mean, there was also that Ledger leak.
That's also a good example.
But I agree in principle that you avoid the entire supply chain attack with a laptop or a phone. It's never going to be as secure as a hardware wallet. Even, the worst hardware wallet is much better than a phone or a laptop in terms of security.
Do you agree with this, Ben?
Yes. So it's different trade-offs in terms of security. So in this sense, it's a supply chain risk versus physical risks and et cetera. But also, there is the option of DIY hardware wallets.
Yeah, so there's You can basically flash the same firmware that runs on Jade on at least three or four different off-the-shelf boards that you can buy on Amazon or AliExpress, like M5 Stack or the T-Display, and there's a couple more. And also there's a DIY Spectre.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is the Spectre DIY, which is a more expensive one, but is also supporting QR codes communication and is completely off the shelf. So there are very different trade-offs, and you could use a hard wallet, which is DIY, in order to avoid supply chain risk, but then you have to do a bit more work in like assembling and flashing firmware and stuff like that. So it's always trade-off between some things, either convenience and usability and security, physical security, supply chain risks. All of that needs to be taken into account. I think for most users, using a hard wallet still makes it the best trade-off. But it can very much depend personally on your personal skills, etc.
Yeah, and just to finish, I would say that the most secure thing I believe out there right now would be to use all of these hardware wallets in multisig together, because then even if one of these manufacturers is bad, or even if you get a supply chain attack on you know, receiving one of those, the fact that you have so many different hardware wallets from different brands and different teams and so on, means that one single one cannot compromise you. Whatever is your K of N, multi-sig, you know.
Yeah, you can buy like five hardware wallets from different manufacturers and make a 3 out of 5 setup or something like that.
And then someone will need to compromise 3 hardware wallets before they can get your funds.
Exactly.
And this is possible on Spectre,
yes,
right?
So Spectre is used for that. Yes, it allows you both single-sig but also multi-sig with all of these hardware wallets in any combination you would like. So it's a very different security model compared to just trusting a single hardware wallet.
Right. Well, interesting. I actually learned something during the recording of this podcast. I always pretend to ask questions that I already know, but this time I actually learned something. So thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Lawrence. Ben, thanks a lot for helping me out here.
For sure.
And for keeping Lawrence honest. This was the Van Wertheim Sure Senado. Thank you for listening.